chest.
If she tells me you went too far, I won't, Sam. I promise.
10 minutes, said Samidia.
Don't leave nothing on that porch, you hear me? Not a fucking fingernail.
Suddenly, he grinned and clapped the other boy on the cheek.
Go on, enjoy it.
The boy vanished into the weedy garden. Only then did Samidia look down at Lantor. He was still grinning.
Fehetri and I are going to make a pile, he says. This is just the beginning. There's 3 more up there.
3 more what?
Girls, Hinchman. 3 more old enough for tricks.
They haven't agreed yet, but they will, once they see what Fehetri's bringing in.
Until then, she'll do. You can see her titties for 5 gam. Touch them for 15.
What does 100 get you?
Samidia hugged Lantor's head to his chest.
Things you're too young to know about, he whispered, like a teasing uncle. That's why you're perfect.
He extinguished the candle, peeked out through the door, and led Lantor back into the street. When he turned to face Lantor again, he held a small loop of iron chain. At the bottom of the loop dangled a key.
Fehetri swiped this from the old bats, he said. The lock's oiled now and working like new. This is what we'll do, Hinchman. I'll send the key to you with somebody on the night you have a job. You slip out and come here and let the customer into the garden. Then you watch and wait. Nobody much on the said Hemmen rode after midnight, and hardly anybody likely to take interest in this dump. But people get nosy, don't they? Sometimes they come looking for trouble.
I don't, said Lantor.
Course not. You're the door guard, Hinchman. You're a part of the team. You give a whistle if anyone starts up the path.
The customer will clear out quick. Shut the door and lock it behind him and scamper off yourself into the bush. Nothing else.
It's an important job, Hinchman. You'll be paid every time.
He handed over the key, along with a piece of chalk.
Make a doodle on the wall.
Why?
Because that's your cover. You're doodling. You're playing a prank. An older lout like me gets seen here, there's no way to explain it. But you, you're practically in diapers. No one could think ill of you, could they now? You've probably never even had a stiffy.
A what?
You see? A stiffy's what a lick can give you.
I don't understand, Sam, said Lantor.
But Lantor learned on the job. Samidia left him in the doorway, and he looked in just in time to see a girl somewhat older than Samidia emerging from the orphanage with a finger to her lips. The boy from his gang dropped his pants right in front of the girl and hoisted her frock. So that was a stiffy. And that, oh, that. It wasn't worth 100 gam, but the boy looked as though he would have paid any price. The girl just looked absent, as though she had taken refuge in some chamber deep in her body, from which the boy was trying in vain to dig her out. Less than 5 minutes later, she twisted away from him and hurried back into the building, and the boy stumbled, dazed and bedraggled, to the potting shed. Lantor was so stunned by his transformation, sweaty, glassy-eyed, one hand in his pants, that he forgot to ask for his 4 remaining gam. It was the only night he made such a mistake. And there were many nights, up to 4 a week, when the news began to spread. For Lantor, the job had a changeless rhythm. The key slipped into his pocket by one of the boys in the gang, the time a whisper in his ear. The scramble along the deserted road, the impatient customer loitering in the shadow of the wall. Lantor's hand extended, 6 in advance. The ecstasy of earning, of not asking his mother for coin. A second girl began to alternate with Fehetri, and then a third. Sometimes they fought with the men. Silent blows, voiceless curses, a weird pantomime of lust and rage. The 3 girls were nearing 20 and saving money toward the day of their freedom, or so Samidia claimed. Lantor rarely saw Samidia at the orphanage. The real money changed hands elsewhere, long before the trysts. If the gang leader appeared at all, it was in the manner of a surprise inspection, a quick nod to Lantor, a proprietary squint at the figures on the porch.
But this makes no sense, blurts Condry. All that thumping, all that sex, how did they get away with it, night after night?
Don't you see, says Chindelin. They didn't get away with it. They weren't fooling anyone. That was part of the sham.
The handmaids had tried for 50%, but settled for a third. It was filthy money, but what else to do with these destitute creatures? Did they have prospects? Did they have suitors? Were they ready for life? The handmaids sighed and cursed the coldness of the world, and put the money in their pockets. The hush everyone maintained in the garden was out of consideration for the youngest girls. These last words, Chindelin speaks as though they have putrefied.
Consideration for the youngest girls.
There are couriers for every vice. In short order, the news spread by dark whispers across the whole of the valley and even beyond. It was a glad and generous exchange, a brotherhood of predators. Men appeared who wanted licks far younger than 18, and in time such orphans were persuaded to oblige. But even they were not so young as the girl who crept through the weeds one night to speak with Lantor Hingeman. She was 14 at the most, thin and frail, with eyes that belonged to some small tree creature, eyes so large they made the rest of her face seem an afterthought. She rose up from a dark corner of the potting shed and touched his arm. Lantor nearly screamed.
Who are you? Get out of here! Go back to bed!
I'm not one of them. I'm not a whore. I won't do that.
Good for you, said Lantor, meaning it. But get away from me. I can't talk. It's not allowed. Samidia will
let me out.
What?
I have to leave this place. No one will hurt me out in the world. Those stories are lies. I know that. It's here where I'll get hurt. You're a fool. Samidia will come after you. I'll hide from him, she said. And from something much worse than him. I know this for certain. A god told me, in my sleep.
Back inside, back inside!
Frightened now, for he had never seen madness before, Lantor shooed her with both hands. The girl stood her ground. Their eyes met, and Lantor saw her intention at the last possible moment and jumped. He was outside with his back to the rock-hard bamboo and his foot against the door before she reached it, flung herself against it, pushed with all her might. But she was a slight 14, and the door opened outward. Lantor had the advantage and would not be moved. The girl pleaded. Lantor tried not to hear. After a time he realized that the girl was sobbing, and then she fled into the garden, for the customer's time was up.
Who in Ong's hairy armpit was that?
The man demanded when Lantor led him out into the street.
Nobody,
said Lantor, turning the key in the lock. He had never, of course, been more wrong. This was in the 7th week of Samidia's enterprise. The girl came back the next night and tried again.
Something awful is going to happen, she said. I have to get out of here. I'm supposed to be running by now.
Running where?
Running from what?
Asked Lantor.
From my fate, said the girl. There's still time to escape it. The god told me that, too. But I don't have much longer. Something's coming. Let me out.
She kept a good 6 feet from Lantor Hingeman, almost out of the potting shed, but he stood ready to slam the door all the same.
I don't believe you, he said. You'll tell me anything to get your way. Anything you imagine will scare me.
I'm scared, said the girl.
The customer? The one who's inside now? He saw me this time, and he looked at me funny.
Lantor forced out a laugh.
Stay inside if you don't want them to look. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He didn't come here for you.
She was right, however. The client, a youth from Sharp's Corner with crooked shoulders and a slight hopping limp, did look strangely at the girl as he passed through the courtyard. When he was gone, Lantor glanced in through the door a final time. The girl was standing in the moonlight, appalled. On the next occasion, her face was like stone. She stood as close as she dared and said he could feel her up, or have her, anything he wanted, if only he'd let her go. Lantor was blindsided.
I'm too young, he said,
for it was what Samidia had told him.
And so are you. Don't say such things.
At once, the life returned to her big eyes. She was relieved, and suddenly very pretty.
I can't let you go, he said. Not ever. Samidia would cut off my ears. You'll have to escape some other way.
I've looked for other ways, she said.
There are bars on the windows, padlocks on the doors. This place is a jail.
Lantor looked out at the road.
Come with me, said the girl. I'm allowed to have a friend. I'll take you where you're supposed to go.
His lips felt dead, his teeth all wrong in his mouth.
We're not friends, he told her. And I don't want to go anywhere. I belong right here in the valley.
Are you sure?
Asked the girl. And then the customer, drunk and finished with his girl, swatted her aside and lurched into the shed. The next morning, Lantor walked the 4 miles to Samidia's house and told him he didn't want the job. The older boy slouched in the doorway, looking him up and down.
What's the matter? He said. Someone treating you bad? One of the customers, maybe? One of the girls?
No,
said Lantor.
How about 7 Gamma Night? I was going to give you a raise anyway, soon.
Lantor shook his head.
I just don't want it anymore. The thing is, I trust you, Hingeman. You make a good dog. A good watchdog, I mean. Better if you stick around until I find a replacement.
No, Sam, I won't go there again. I...
Resign.
Resign?
Resign?
Samidia grabbed him by the shoulder. He said that Lantor's mother would be told that her darling boy was a pimp's assistant.
And so will everyone in your life. Your teachers, your brother and sister, your worthless papa, if he ever comes back. They'll know you took money from men who screw little girls. Your whole family will be disgraced, Lantor. Other women won't let your mother scrub their floors. They won't even speak to her, the mother of a pimp. You want that, do you?
Lantor stared at his feet. He did not want that. 2 nights later, he was back at the New Life Orphanage.
I won't look at her face, he reasoned, for he could not be strong enough to deny her again if he saw those bleeding eyes.
But of course, he had to open the door for the customer, a large stranger in a mud-spattered cloak who smelled vaguely of horses, and he was supposed to keep an eye on the man as well as the road. He compromised. He held the door open an inch. When the girl drew near, he saw a ribbon of cheek.
"Who gave you that bruise?" he whispered.
"Fahetri," said the girl.
She brought the dark welt close to the gap. Then she shifted, and he saw her mouth, her thin nose, one probing eye.
"Someone's going to kill me," Lantor thought. "What's your name?"
she asked.
"Lantor."
It didn't matter if she knew. It didn't matter what he said to her. She was going nowhere for 6 years.
"What's yours, then?"
"Tamahin," she said. "It's a Kasraji name. I'm not pure Chiloto. But in the future, everyone will think so."
"Did your god tell you that?"
She nodded seriously. He was shaking like a leaf.
"Lantor," she said, "you have to make up your mind."
"I know,"
he whispered.
"I will." "Not eventually," she said. "You have to decide right now. Because if you don't let me out now, it will be too late."
Her conviction shattered what was left of his poise. What if she did talk to gods? What if he was fighting more than a crazy girl? She slipped a hand through the crack, and he shoved hard, a warning. The hand snapped back.
"No tears," he said, for she was crying again. "It won't work. I'm not listening."
"The man on the porch," she said. "The man with Fahetri right now. He stared at me on the way in, Lantor. He told me. Told me with his look. Never mind,"
Lantor heard himself say.
"Never mind? Are you crazy? Are you just like the rest of them, the same kind of beast? That gimp from Sharp's Corner stared at you too," he said. "But so what? They're just looking. They want older girls. That's what they paid for, isn't it? Let me go, Lantor."
He was going to obey her. He was falling into a pit. The girl knelt down, said she believed in him, that she knew he was different, that his kindness could change the world. he took his hands from the door. Go ahead, he thought. Just push. She didn't notice. She was sobbing, repeating his name. He closed his eyes, shut out her voice with the first thing he thought of, a prayer.
Ang all-merciful, protector of multitudes, nearest in our need.
The door smashed open. Lantor was crushed against the bamboo. The man in the mud-spattered cloak stepped out with the girl under his arm. She was not screaming, only groaning for breath. He had dealt her a blow to the stomach. With his free hand, he lifted Lantor clear of the ground.
You didn't see me take her, he snarled. I left alone, like anybody. That's the only fucking thing you saw.
He slammed Lantor's head against the wall, then flung him aside. Bleeding and all but senseless, Lantor watched him toss the girl over his shoulder and start down the path. The man paused only once, when another figure stepped from the shadows. It was the crooked-shouldered youth from Sharp's Corner, his hand extended, a nervous smile on his face. The man flung a handful of coins at him, contemptuous. From farther down the path, near the said Hemmen Road, came another man's voice.
Hurry the hell up, will you?
And the stamp of horses, eager to run.
And you know what followed,
says Chindelin, squatting on his heels by the fire.
Or at least a version of it. They were flesh traders, Tirmassel, if you like. They didn't need to buy pussy from a hayseed pimp like Samidia. They wanted young girls to sell, especially girls with huge, dark eyes. And they found one, thanks to a young kid named Mars. No. He took shelter in divinity school, the phony bastard, when he saw what he had done. Of course, it was too late by then. And Lantor, he's been making amends all his life. Traveling to war-torn lands, snatching up orphaned kids before the Tirmassel arrive, finding homes for them all. But it's never enough, is it? There's one kid he can't go back and save.
Chindelin pokes at the fire with a stick.
I met him 3 years later, and we've been best friends ever since. I don't believe he's told another soul, except Diakra, of course.
The smith looks at Condry, desolate.
It's consumed his life.
He was 9, says Condry.
Try telling the old man that. I have, for damn near 50 years.
What did they do with the girl?
Chindelin sighs.
Don't go stupid on me now, Condry. They had a buyer already. A man who paid in diamonds for big-eyed girls. The fact that he was a cave-dwelling, Vajek-slaughtering Chiloto warlord didn't matter one bit.
Condry stands, clutching his ridiculous teacup. He cannot speak. Like his father half a century ago, he feels himself falling, head over heels, into a lightless pit.
Warlord? He croaks at last. The warlord, says Chindelin. Bitruk Uslor, who made his base at Hunger Cliff, who added that girl to his stable of wives and sired 4 sons on her.
Chindelin raises his fingers, counting.
Jihalkra, Ojulon, Garatajik, Ataril. I don't know where this white child came from, whether she created it or called it up from hell. I don't know how she came by her gifts. But that girl was our prophet, Condry. And the vision that came to her a few years later? The rising of the Chiloto, Heaven's Path, and the War of Revelation? I suppose that was the fate she was trying to avoid.
The water is only lukewarm, but while he is soaking, a youth from the Hill Clans appears with a great clay vessel held by tongs. It is glowing at the base. Condry stands, numb and naked. The youth empties it into the copper bathing tub. Condry sits. Now the water is too hot, burning, really, but the pain is a distant thing. The dried blood lifts from his forearms in translucent flakes. He scrubs himself. There is a feast laid out in the main chamber that he could not make himself touch. He is soaking in the blood of the Tower Watchman. He is drowning in the blood of the world. Like his father, those three guards were told to stand and wait for trouble to find them. Three weeds, cut down by all-powerful happenstance, the great mower of mankind. No, Khandri, cut down by your brother and you. The youth is also waiting, peering anxiously at Khandri's face.
Thank you, says Khandri.
Go away now. I don't want anything else.
Dethin Sarananasin ko.
Khandri cannot even identify the language. Kasraji? He tries. The youth shakes his head. No imperial common. Maybe it never penetrated these hills. Khandri puts his hands together, palm to palm, hoping his thanks will at least be understood. The youth hesitates, then bows and slips away. As he lifts the curtain, Khandri sees Mektu in his own bath, 20 feet away. His head is thrown back as though his neck is broken. He is sound asleep. The prophet's name is Tamahin. Or was. Khandri has never heard so much as a whispered rumor that she possessed an earthly name. A Kasraji name. The mother of all Chilotos is only part Chiloto. We worship a mongrel. And without her, we'd still be in chains. Khandri slides down, plunging his head below the surface. Too hot. Stay down anyway. Burn out your eyes. Endless war. Misery, horror, theft, poisoned fields, burning villages, burning houses, screams of children within. A liberation become a march of hate and slaughter. A fever dream of 11 sons on 11 thrones. All Uroth bowing before one family, before one twisted, unstoppable lie. That was what his father was carrying. The blame for all of it. Because he'd been afraid to open a door.
Egotist! How can you cling to that? You were a child, Papa. No child can be held to the standards of a man.
He rises. Next to the tub stands Eshet, wrapped in a white sarong. He sits up so quickly that water sloshes onto the floor.
What's the matter? He demands, covering himself.
Nothing's the matter. Hush.
She is freshly bathed. Steam rises from her skin. Something about her face has changed, as though some force has taken hold and reimagined it. The knowing eyes, the wet locks plastered against her cheeks.
That servant, she said. He was trying to tell you that we're expected below, in 10 minutes. You and your uncle talked a long fucking time.
10 minutes?
Eshet shrugs.
Forget I told you. If they want you on time, they should send someone who can speak your language.
She steps closer, until she is alongside his knees. Through the wet muslin he can see all of her, save the breasts concealed by one arm. He tries to avert his eyes, succeeds in averting one of them, momentarily. Why hasn't he looked at her before? This desert woman, this Parthen who held him in a tunnel beneath a grave.
Eshet, my brother is in love with you.
It doesn't matter, she says. In 2 days, I'll rejoin my clan. I'm a sand rat, and he'll never be. It doesn't matter what we feel.
And me. I love. There's this woman.
Don't say it. Don't say her name again. You think I don't know?
Where's my uncle?
All at once, she is exasperated.
Somewhere else. Echim Baruch, can't you ever stop talking? I am clean. Hurry up.
He lifts a hand from the water, reaches for her, grazes her hip through the sarong.
You don't understand, he pleads, withdrawing the hand. What uncle told me was too terrible. There's no way.
She puts a hand under his chin.
You're afraid that you're a bad man, she says. Stop thinking that. It's not true.
Her fingers rise, trembling, teasing his lips.
When I go, I'll never see you again. I want Anga with you. Sweet Anga. That's all.
I'm sorry, he says, turning away.
So I disgust you, maybe? What? You have ideas about Parthians? Our bad habits? Our smell?
Eshet. Eshet, no.
Why don't you say it? I'm still dirty in your eyes. Once a whore, always...
He puts his lips to her sex, clumsy, the muslin between them thinner than smoke. He no longer knows anything. The world is broken. His arm is tight around her hips. Her body shudders. Her dark curls wet his face. Maybe he's crying. There are yards of this white stuff. Her hands strong on the back of his neck, she leans into him and whispers his name, and no, he's not crying, except with gladness, maybe. Eshet, beautiful Eshet, and then the muslin parts, and her leg hooks over his shoulder, and his tongue finds the way. When they return to the general's council, it is as if no time has passed at all. The whole company is present, the fire bright, the wine making the rounds. Chindelin is brooding. Mektu, his hair still wet, looks sleepy and disoriented. Khandri is disoriented for very different reasons. Only Eshet is perfectly herself. Tabassa, who warned them to reach the cavern on time or not at all, makes no mention of their lateness. He asks if their new clothes fit, if the food is to their liking. They answer yes without hesitation. All of them, even Khandri, have just wolfed down beef and yams and bread and apples, squatting in a circle, eating with both hands.
"And the baths?" asks the general.
Khandri swallows. Chindelin's mouth works as if he were chewing a lemon.
"The baths were perfect," says Eshet.
"You've treated us like princes, general," says Mektu.
"Better," says Tabassa. "Our young Prince Naraba is out there with the camels and dogs."
The room explodes with nervous laughter. Suddenly, Mektu drops to one knee, crosses the knee with his forearm, and bows his head until eyebrows meet wrist. Khandri and Chindelin glance at each other and quickly mimic the gesture, as they know they must. It is an old and formal salute. Tabassa looks very pleased.
"Rise, rise," he says, and they do.
The whole room is beaming, none more so than the general himself.
"I grant favors only to the deserving," he says. "And tell me, who is more deserving than the killers of the prophet's sons?"
Silence, quick as a candle snuffed. The general twists around to look at his men.
"You heard me. These are the assassins who struck Eternity Camp. No cheering now. There are civilians nearby. We don't want the whole of the Arig Hills to know who we've added to our company."
Khandri feels the prickling of hairs along his arms. Our company. He knows at once that he must speak, must shatter Tabassa's implication before it can harden into fact.
"We haven't joined your company," he blurts.
"You've not had the chance until now," says Tabassa.
"But, General, we can't, and we never asked to. We have our own plans." Sharp looks from the soldiers. Chindelin clamps his big hand on Khandri's shoulder. "Slow down." The general shows no surprise, but his smile has faded.
"What do you suppose we're discussing here, Mr. Hingerman? A social club? A farmer's cooperative? No doubt there are some houses where a man may come begging and pounding on the door, and then hesitate when the door is thrown open. But this house is not among them. We are the Unified Survival Forces. As long as you're willing to aid that survival, you're our brothers, and we'll move heaven and earth for you."
"We need your aid, General," says Chindelin. "But we need it to make good our escape. From the very start, we've known what we had to do. Reach the great desert and vanish from the prophet's sight. We're almost there. All we need is your good word to that Mr. Ithimar."
"My good word," says the general. "Is that so slight a thing?"
"You know we can't remain in the Lutaral," says Khandri. "There's no safety for us here."
"One can live without safety," says the general. "Some of us have done so all our lives. A true soldier dwells on other things. Honor, to start with. And as my grandfather used to say, honor to end with, and honor at every point in between. Make that your focus, Corporal Hingeman, and let safety take care of itself. You will learn once you've been among us a while.
Condry feels a stab of cold in his chest. Here it is, the doctor's bill. The cost of keeping Mektu alive.
But they're not soldiers, says Eshet, looking hard at the general. Not good ones, anyway. They're bunglers, idiots. They'd be useless to you.
They take knives to the prophet's children, says Tabassa. The ones she claims the gods themselves have chosen to be her ministers when she rules over Uroth. And you call them bunglers? That is fanciful, I must say. Now be still.
He straightens, and Condry has the impression that he would like very much to rise from his chair. In the room's perfect silence, he looks from face to face. At last his eyes settle on Eshet again.
You, Parthan woman, can go your own way with our blessing. Seek your people, resume your life. But for you three,
his gaze swivels to the men,
I suggest you pause and reflect. You are still not so very far from home. One day we will emerge victorious, not just in the Lutaral, but in all these western lands, and men like you will return to the Satapre Valley as liberators. But cut the cord, and who knows what you will become? Drifters, faithless men, vassals of some country so strange to you that your hearts will only sleep there, and your days be dross, if you even live to see such a place.
You're trying to scare us, General Tabassa, says Condry.
It is your plight that should scare you, says Tabassa. The choice you face is stark. Join the survival forces and have a family. Embrace our code, our dangers, our loves. You may find lifelong mates among us. You will certainly find satisfaction for your natural wants. But above all, you will find honor. We are true men and women. We do not fuss and fiddle about and tell half lies for the sake of convenience. We live and die by our word, and we fight for the restoration of a just rule in our corner of Uroth. It is a fight Lantor Hingeman understood when he sat beside me in this room.
The thought flashes instantly through Condry's mind. But he didn't join you, did he?
General, sir, where is he?
Mektu pleads.
Join us,
continues Tabassa, as though he has not heard the question.
Or strike out alone into a hostile world. No other way for you exists. I know the dream you have followed thus far. I know there is a certain face that teases your hearts, a girl's face, and a sweet voice to go with it. But that girl is no more, lads. She left you cold in the Satapre. She has either perished or found another love, and built another life in which you play no part.
Mektu is trembling a little. Condry, abashed and furious, looks at Chindelin and Eshet, but their wide eyes protest their innocence. Who told this old monster about Arikina, then? Talupeke? What had Chindelin shared with her on that hilltop in the Stolen Sea?
I've struck the mark, haven't I?
Says Tabassa, for once without a hint of a smile.
An exquisite lover, was she? Hands made to touch you, a voice to cut your heart, the closest thing to perfection in this world? Don't be ashamed, lads. You're hardly alone. Look at the faces around you. Everyone's perfect love is lost. Fortunately, imperfect love comes at need, and with care and dedication grows into something fine, if unimagined. Wait and see.
He makes a flicking gesture with two fingers and a thumb.
Or don't wait, he says. Keep running from life, and good luck to you, but do not base your choice on an illusion.
An illusion, General? Says Condry.
Lad, says Tabassa. All the miles and wounds and visions and noble suffering a soul can endure will not restore her to your arms.
He sits back, crossing his arms. His perfect seriousness, the disappearance of any teasing or derision, somehow unsettles Condrey immensely. The whole room waits in silence. Clearly the travelers are to tender their decision here and now. Condrey turns to the others and sees the same terrible anxiety he feels. Pledge themselves to Tabassa? Ridiculous. Not this side of hell. And yet, whispers a second part of himself, it would be an answer of sorts, a refuge, to become soldiers again, once more a part of a whole, and this time a whole small enough for the mind to grasp, small enough that everyone would soon learn your name. To be executing another's decisions, to lose this exhausting burden of choice. And with it, Arikina. Condrey pinches shut his eyes. All rubbish, manipulation, a steaming pile of goat shit. Black Hat Tabassa cannot protect them from the Prophet. He can't even protect himself, the old fool. Don't lie to yourself, Condrey. Tabassa's no fool. Even a wise man's luck runs out eventually. Look at Garatajik. Ah, Garatajik. Who else is going to see that his letter reaches Dr. Tsirim? And suppose I agree that Tabassa's intelligent. That doesn't mean he's not a conceited old prick. How dare he talk of abandoning love? What does he know of our bond, mine and Arikina's? Whatever made her run off wasn't lack of love for me. But you've just been with Eshet. What does that say about your bond? Condrey will not answer that question. He wants to be with her again, tonight, as soon as possible. Then persuade her to stay with you. No, no, no. Imagine the madness that would erupt in your brother. He'd never forgive you. Not after Ari chose you as well. Hundreds of eyes on them. Tight, calm smiles. The general always gets his way. So think once more, Condrey. What if it is the best way? What other allies have you found since you crawled under that fence at Eternity Camp? And isn't he already working to put you in touch with your father? More to the point, wouldn't you be dead already without Tabassa's help? How is dead the better choice than alive and delayed? Condrey shakes himself. He knows all about delay. There is nothing for it. They must refuse. They must go to the outer cavern and buy passage with that caravan, help Eshet reach her village, brave the desert and all it contains, and yes, find their way to Khosrallis and to Arikina. Sometimes the fate you see is a good one, not a horror. Sometimes you shouldn't try to escape. To his immense relief, he sees the same resolve in his brother's face. Silently, Mektu mouths, "We should leave." Condrey has to smile. It is what his brother has been telling him for months. Eshet meets his eye and nods, places a hand on her chest. "I'm with you." Condrey smiles at her, loving her, grateful beyond words. How had Tabassa's offer even made him hesitate? The absurdity, the sheer lunacy of the idea. Chindelin. He is staring at the entrance. Telupeke has slipped into the room. She is winded, gasping, her riding clothes soaked through with sweat, mouth sarcastic, eyes imploring, holding herself as still as possible and holding the smith like a bird cupped in a hand. Eshet, fearful, touches Chindelin on the arm. The smith shrugs her off with a twitch. Then he draws a deep breath and turns away from Talupeke.
"Time we were leaving," he whispers in Chilot.
Their decision causes an uproar. Growls give way swiftly to hisses, muttered oaths. Tabassa sits quietly, bemused. Stilts, with a worried look in his old eyes, attempts once more to change their mind, but he and everyone else know the struggle is over.
"We're not ungrateful, General," says Chindelin. "Your generosity means a great deal to us. Not so very much, it appears. You're wrong there, sir. We aren't faithless men. In fact, we're trying to keep a promise. To whom?
Chindelin works his hands, looking suddenly miserable. He cannot possibly mention Garatajik.
Another benefactor, he says lamely. And where is this mysterious person?
Khandri leaps to answer. Khosrowshahr City, General.
Khosrowshahr, says the General. How in Aang's wildest dreams do you propose to get there?
As part of that caravan, of course, says Khandri. At least until we reach the far shores of the desert. Then we can take our leave and finish the journey alone.
The caravan is out of the question, says Tavassa.
Why is that, General? Asks Chindelin.
Because it departed hours ago, with my consent.
Now it is the travelers who cry out in shock and rage. A deception. A trick. The General gives a casual signal, and his soldiers rush to lay hands on the four. Khandri lashes out, but he is immobilized before he can land a single blow. The others fare no better. In seconds, the three men are subdued, and Eshet is forced into a chair, her hands held firmly behind her. Khandri looks hard at the General.
Honor, he says.
Mansari turns with a whip-crack motion, striking him in the jaw. Khandri does not cry out or avert his eyes from the General. A taste of blood on his tongue. Mansari wears rings.
Honor is for brethren, says Tavassa. I am bound by many promises to my soldiers, none to you.
My friends made no promises either, says Eshet.
Nor does a man swimming alongside a boat and begging for rescue, says Stilts, a few paces behind the General. Once aboard, though, he's got to abide by the skipper's rules.
Or be returned to the, elements, adds Mansari.
Release them, says the General. If they misbehave again, cut them to pieces.
The soldiers step away from the travelers. The nearest dozen draw their blades.
General Black Hat, says Mektu, I'd like to explain something. Eshet is telling the truth. We aren't what we seem.
Obviously not, says the General. For you seem to be a witless ape with too much spittle in your mouth, and yet you hacked a path of death from Eternity Camp to my door. And when do you choose to arrive? Why, at the start of a true Darsanuk, a time of madness, plain as any storybook. Right down to the gods' flaming tears.
Mektu gives him a lopsided smile.
There's a lot more madness about than you realize, General.
Trust me, boy. I've seen every sort in Uroth.
Not my sort.
The other travelers flinch, gazing at Mektu like a trio of murderers.
Stop, Khandri howls at him silently. Don't say another fucking word.
Tavassa leans forward, eyes keen as a raptor's.
We're not special, says Mektu. But all these things that we've done, that have happened to us, it's more than bad luck. When you struggle in a net, you just get more tangled.
You're about to prove that point again.
Things went wrong from the start, says Mektu. Khandri attacked the priest because his girl disappeared. I mean, my girl. She's mine. And the town elders put him in jail, and the priest said 11 years, but then our captain went to the old man and made an offer. 2 for 1, he said.
2 sons of heaven?
No, 2 recruits, says Mektu. The prophet had nothing to do with it, really. Sometimes her priests act alone. Father Mars, for example. Girls went to him for destiny services, to pray for rich husbands, not to be groped under their frocks.
That's enough, says Tavassa.
He hated our family, says Mektu. And he took it out on me, in my boyhood, before Khandri and I ever met. That's where it all started, sir.
Mektu lifts a trembling hand to his temples.
And now it's back, you see. It's happening again.
Oh, gods of death. Mektu is about to speak of the Yatra, and that could be fatal. Some of the fiercest warriors Khandri has ever known are afraid of the soul thieves. And even if Tavassa does not believe in the wicked spirits, what if his men do? What if this ruthless general knows full well the danger of Yatra terror in the ranks? A number of warriors already look suspicious. Mansari is studying Mektu with narrowed eyes. Panicked, Condry leans close to his brother's ear.
Shut the fuck up, he whispers in Chalot.
No, I'll keep talking, says Mektu aloud. I'll speak my mind while it's still mine to speak. General Tabassa, the main thing is...
Condry, scalded by shame, pokes his brother right in his wound. Mektu howls. He turns, grabs Condry by the throat, but when Condry makes no move to protect himself, his brother hesitates, one fist raised to strike. For a moment, no one knows quite what is happening. Then the man called Spider rises to his feet.
General, he says, may I speak bluntly, sir?
Tabassa sighs.
Why not, Captain? Perhaps you can elevate these proceedings.
Spider bows.
I have served you 20 years, General. In that time you have always shunned those whose presence would make us a target, unless they be committed body and soul to our cause.
He gestures at the travelers.
These four deserve nothing. They spurn our offer of brotherhood. And if they have truly killed the sons of the great Chiloto bitch, they are marked men, marked like no one we have ever harbored. They wish to go? Let them. But with no further assistance, save our boots to their backsides.
There are murmurs of agreement. A great many, in fact. Condry glances at Chindelin's face, sees concern there to match his own. The ground is shifting again.
I wish you no harm, Chilotos, Spider continues. Beyond all doubt, you are marvelous killers, prodigies even, to have struck as you did.
Not true, says Eshet.
But you are not our killers, says Spider, and we have already rewarded you handsomely. Our sister Yahida Chen sheltered you. Our influence opened the Zavacindran's door and saved one of you from death.
My acting talents opened that door, says Mektu.
Chindelin, his breaking point reached at last, leans over and cuffs the side of Mektu's head.
Ouch! Cries Mektu. What's that for? What did I say?
You are the strangest men, says Tabassa.
Strange or simple, they have no right to ask more of us, General, says Spider.
The affirmative voices are louder now. A second figure rises, the woman soldier from Opuk's Mill, the one with the immensely strong arms.
General Tabassa, she says, Spider is right. Assassins bring death to those who shelter them. We fight the Prophet already, Aang knows, but we are not first among her enemies. If they remain with us, that will change. Even aiding them further could lead that mad woman to seek revenge. Look what the mere rumor of their presence has done to Mab Makutan. And their eyes are stained, puts in another. They'll be spotted anywhere we go.
They will be our doom, says Spider. Let us be rid of them, General, while there is still time. Drive them off.
Nearly all the soldiers cry out in assent. Only those nearest the general, Stilts, Mansari, the old woman who had clashed with Spider, begin to argue to the contrary.
Drive them off, says Stilts. You might as well stab them dead and be done with it. Have you no hearts?
The uproar is passionate. But after several minutes, a quiet laugh bubbles up through the mayhem. Tabassa's laugh. When the soldiers perceive it, they fall silent at once. Tabassa wipes his eyes.
Ah, Spider, he says. You have read the situation perfectly, but the lesson you draw from it is backwards. You think I've brought them here out of mercy, out of gratitude? Come, am I not your black hat?
You don't even wear a hat, says Mektu.
Interrupt me again, slobbering ape, says Tabassa, still smiling. And by the gods, I'll take that poker from the fire and burn the tongue from your mouth and your manhood from between your legs.
Mektu hides his face in his elbow.
Survival is for the cleverest, says the general. Not just the strongest or most skilled with a knife. Yes, these men have spurned our friendship. They may live to regret that choice. But we shall keep them in our pocket nonetheless. Survival means wasting no tools.
He twists again in his chair.
And what sort of tool are they, pray? Can't one of you tell me?
Eyes flash around the room. The fire crackles.
Condry glances again at Mansari, sees the corners of his lips slowly curl into a smile.
A dog whistle, he says.
Tabassa nods. An irresistible dog whistle, lads. An enchanted whistle. The kind that could send the prophet anywhere we like. Look, says Sister Chiat, at what the mere rumor of their presence has done. Look indeed. You there, Condry, tell us how the Ersad of Mab Makutin fares tonight.
Condry's nails bite into his palms.
The Ersad is dead, he says.
Now the cries are amazed and joyful. The soldiers look at one another almost in disbelief, as though a great burden had suddenly been lifted from their hearts.
The brothers Hingeman spend 15 hours in that town, says Tabassa, and bring an end to 20 years of rule by that backstabbing Ersad. What do you suppose the prophet will do when she learns that they have been glimpsed in Sendu? When rumor has them breaking bread with the younger Sartaf? We can kindle that rumor easily enough. It might not even be necessary to take the fools there.
One of the soldiers laughs aloud.
Ong's tears, General! The great whore will go mad!
And when the legions of Sendu lie eviscerated, and still the brothers are not found?
Smiles all around the chamber.
Another rumor? Says Jiat.
You have it, sister. Let the prophet hear that they have slipped north through her fingers, say, into the embrace of the Vajeks. With a little taunting and needling, she will follow the blood sent north and abandon Sendu.
To us, says Spider.
To us, agrees Tabassa. As it should be. Can't you see what we have here, brothers and sisters? The Hingemans are priceless. They will clear mountains from our path.
Looks of hope and wonder. The bulk of Tabassa's soldiers are convinced. Weapons are raised in unison. Suddenly, the whole room is chanting.
Black hat! Black hat!
We're tools, thinks Condry. Nothing else. He planned this from the start. And yet, there are doubters in the chamber. Stilts is not smiling, nor is Mansari, whose gaze has not left Mektu. Chindelin is wild-eyed.
General, he says, if you'd only cut the face of the next one who speaks uninvited, says Tabassa. Better yet, cut the other two. Don't touch the Parthian woman, however. She is blameless, as far as we know.
As he speaks, his gaze lifts to the back of the chamber, to Talipeke. The girl's back is to the wall, and her expression is stricken. With guilt? With pity? She must have answered all of Tabassa's questions. Did she ask any of her own?
We have taken the liberty of removing your effects from the high chambers, says Tabassa. There is a padlocked cell in the warren behind me. That will do for you, I think. And I'll have to ask you to return those clothes. You have others, I trust?
The travelers say nothing. Condry takes care not to glance at Stilts. You know about the clothes we purchased. You haven't reported our every word. That's interesting.
Our guests are less talkative suddenly, says the general. No matter. Bring it all to me.
A path opens, and the travelers' mud-stiffened backpacks are arranged before the general. Men open the buckles, tear at the rawhide knots. Condry's breath grows short.
You vile fucker. You're going to—
Rope?
Says Tabassa, tugging the dusty coil from Mektu's pack.
Empty Fosca? Sealed Fosca? A melted candle? That's a fool thing to carry. Salt plums? Sugared dates? A copper cookpot? Someone's idea of a hat.
As he names each item, Tabassa sends it flying into the crowd. His men, taking the cue, begin to rend the clothes, stomp on the breakables, gnaw the leathery food.
Underclothes! Great gods, burn them! No, don't, actually. We'd send the whole cavern running from the smell.
High hilarity grips the chamber. Mektu feeds it by his fury,
seething and bucking in the soldier's grasp, but not daring to speak. Condry shares his rage, though he manages to deny the warriors the pleasure of seeing it. Chindelin just looks lost. He is searching the chamber with his eyes, for Talipeke, Condry thinks. But the girl has disappeared. The Mataglin, thinks Condry suddenly. He'll take that too, unless he leaves Eshet's pack alone. Tabasa has moved on to Condry's belongings.
Fish meal? Tooth powder? There's someone who means to survive. A fine field telescope. Hold on to that for me, Stilts. And see here. They're not paupers after all.
Tabasa holds up the purse of coins from Garatajik. Condry's heart, if possible, sinks even lower.
Good and heavy, says the general.
He hands the purse to Stilts.
We'll hold that in trust, to pay for their food and water and other expenses. You can start by subtracting the cost of that bribe you paid to get them past the gate at Mab Makutin. Well now, what's this?
Condry's eyes snap up. Oh no. You bastard, don't fucking touch it.
No!
Tabasa is holding the stiff leather envelope containing Garatajik's letter to Dr. Sirim, Arikina's hero, the great physician of Kasralis. Condry hurls himself at the general, to no avail. The men just grip him tighter, laughing. Tabasa notes his distress with amusement as an aide saws through the rawhide stitching. No, no, no! Condry has never in his life felt so impotent. He cannot even speak. The aide pulls the envelope apart. Within is a second envelope, of heavy linen with a curious sheen.
Waxed, says the general. Against moisture, and...
He sniffs.
I thought so. Infused with sulfur, against the nibbling of insects or mice. Someone was very keen on this letter's survival. What do you say, brothers, sisters? I confess my curiosity's aroused.
Open it! Open it!
The soldiers are having the time of their lives. Tabasa nods. If you insist. He tears open the letter, flattens the pages on his knee. Chindelin makes a strangled sound. Eyes bulging, chest heaving like a draft horse, he manages to drag the six men holding him a yard closer to the general. Mansari slips casually between them, looking the smith up and down. Condry recalls the words his uncle reported. Garatajik's words. That letter must reach Dr. Tsirim. If I could trade my life for its certain delivery, I should do so at once. Chindelin heaves again, and at the same time, Mansari moves in a blur. A slash with one foot at Chindelin's ankle, an elbow thrust into his neck. The smith's face spasms with pain as he crashes to the floor.
You will have to forego the, beard trim.
Purrs Mansari.
Dear me, says the general, holding the letter above the fray.
Turning it to catch the torchlight, he reads in a loud, mock-formal voice.
To my cherished senior colleague, mistress of medicine and science, Dr. Sirim Fesjamu, may all benevolent powers rain down gladness upon you.
Shouts and jeers at the formal language. Tabasa glances at the travelers like a schoolteacher making sure he has his pupils' attention.
I beg you to forgive this most irregular of letters, but I find that two couriers unforeseen and indeed undesirable, you brothers, I presume, are departing the Malaya even now in great haste, there's an understatement, with your city as their ultimate goal. Therefore, without the least elaboration... Good sir, you elaborate amply. I beg leave to inform you that I have solved our algebraic enigma. I do not jest. Read on, doctor, but be seated, for what you hold in your hand is nothing less than...
Tabasa's voice dies. His lips freeze in mid-utterance. He raises his eyes to his warriors but does not appear to see them. Silence falls. The entire room holds its breath as the old warrior tries to master himself. He gestures, the beginning of an order, but his hand shakes,
and the words do not come. He looks down at the letter again, as though waiting for it to disappear. When it does not, the hand that holds